Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Mary Kissel of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal joins me tonight. Mary, we're going to do politics, and I have a sense that after we do politics, we're going to want to clear our minds and head to Australia. How's that for you?
Oh, that sounds fine for me. I thought you were going to say we were going to go to religion after politics,
no,
John.
No, we're going to go to Australia after politics,
okay.
Because the president is outbound for Australia. He's
in
leaving.
The most faraway places, too. He's not even going to the nice places in Australia.
The president's leaving with Air Force One and a very large retinue. He's heading to Hawaii for the ASEAN conference, which is critical always when they meet in the Pacific. And then he's going to Australia, which he's managed to fail twice before because of events. And we can only hope in these next hours something bad doesn't happen.
You can't.
Because it's happened twice before. It happens twice before.
Yeah.
But all of Oz is waiting for the President of the United States, and we will speak to Australia momentarily. However, we begin tonight with a story that is global, truly global. We know this because Tegan Goddard, who keeps Political Wire, has already hinted that there is an event in the Republican candidacy for Rick Perry that now defines presidential debates. This will be, in 100 years, the go-to moment. Tegan, a very good evening to you. What has Governor Perry done?
What Governor Perry has done with his debate performance last night, which I'm sure there's not a single one of your listeners that doesn't know about right now, he's gone viral. I mean, people who don't pay attention to politics now are looking at this clip of him forgetting his own proposal to cutting government agencies. It's one of the most painful 54 seconds you've ever seen, probably the most painful debate moment in American, at least modern American debate history. And he's probably got an invite coming to Saturday Night Live. And if he doesn't do it, I'm sure they have someone to play him.
But, Tegan, this wasn't an isolated incident. Mr. Perry has had problems in several of the previous debates, and yet he vows to fight on. What did this big blooper last night say about his chances as he forges ahead?
Well, the big problem for Rick Perry is that his performance last night, if it was the only time he did it, perhaps it would be survivable. It's just that it points to everything, all of his previous performances, which haven't been that good. It really highlights the fact that he's not ready for prime time. He certainly is not ready to face Barack Obama, who obviously after his own presidential campaign and then 3 years as president is about as polished as you're going to get, in terms of debating. And Republicans can't see him on a podium next to Barack Obama in a general election campaign.
Mary, I'd like to know whether you think that the governor of Texas worked up to this moment. Did he prepare us through the first five debates for this scale of a blooper? He was not sharp. And so what we were watching,
John,
was a rehearsal.
That's kind of mean.
If he'd done this on the first debate, we would have forgiven it, correct?
I don't think so, John.
It was the serial missteps that took us to this scale of oops.
Well, it does rank up there. I think Michael Baroni said tonight that this was quite possibly the worst moment he's ever seen since he started watching debates in the Kennedy era.
All right, little history here, Tegan. How does this match up with Admiral Stockdale, who's an enormously admired person, but had what you'd have to say was a debate oops moment when he was on Ross Perot's ticket in 1992. Is this because before the age of YouTube? This supplants this because social media now dominates.
I think that's exactly right. The other thing is that was a vice presidential debate, and it was a third party candidate. Rick Perry had so much promise. I mean, many people thought that he could be president of the United States. Many people thought that he was going to be a shoe-in. You go back 6-8 weeks ago. Many people thought that he was going to knock Romney out. Finally, you had a strong Republican candidate in the race. He's been nothing but a strong candidate, with the exception of his ability to raise money in that first month. But ever since, he's proven himself far from perfect, as he himself says. But that moment last night, certainly, I've watched an awful lot of debates. I've dug up clips of old debates on YouTube. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite so painful.
Mitt Romney, governor of Massachusetts, in hometown Michigan last night, his home state where he was raised by the governor of Michigan, has performed extremely adequately through six debates. And I'm going to put forward a thesis and let Mary and Tegan comment. The thesis is this, that Governor Perry misplayed 2008. He poured an enormous amount of money into Iowa. He was there often. He was always giving us PowerPoint demonstrations how he was going to piece together the march to the nomination. Didn't work out. Iowa rejected him. This time he said, I'm not going to do Iowa. Here we are with less than 60 days to go. I think Governor Romney's in a place right now to win Iowa quietly, narrowly, and then with New Hampshire in his pocket because he was governor of Massachusetts, he's got the nomination. Mary?
Well, it's not like Romney has ignored Iowa. He's been permanently campaigning for the last, what, 4 or 5 years now? I don't know if I agree with the premise of your thesis. Tegan, what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting thesis, and I think that obviously Mitt Romney becomes a much stronger candidate if he can prove that he can win in Iowa as well. And the polls have him right there with Herman Cain, and I think that's part of the problem. Herman Cain is a wounded candidate right now. Some private polls that the Associated Press obtained today suggest that Herman Cain is starting to fade in Iowa, that his support was in the 22-23% range, according to the Des Moines Register poll. It's now in the double digits still, but quite a bit lower, down around the 12-14% range. So if Cain is fading, the only question for John's thesis there is, will someone rise up? And that someone...
Here it comes.
Someone who could play in both South Carolina and in Florida, two very important races in the first four, could be Newt Gingrich.
Tegan's got his Newt mug out when he's talking about this.
Our eyes are rolling here.
I mean, if Newt Gingrich actually is the next Republican to rise up as the anti-Romney, then I don't think John's thesis is quite so secure at that point.
I can see it now. Newt leading in the polls in Iowa and South Carolina. Mary, here comes the Speaker of the House. He's certainly the most voluble of all the candidates. And in a press conference, would it ever end?
Does anybody remember all of the negatives of Newt Gingrich in the 90s?
I don't remember anything.
Has that just been
erased
from our minds?
You know, it's hard to remember. I mean, the negatives about these candidates are so extraordinary at this point. I mean, Mitt Romney has taken every side of every issue, it seems, and he's on YouTube on every side of every issue, yet that somehow doesn't seem to matter. Herman Cain is fighting through his own personal problems of 15, 20 years ago. Newt Gingrich has more baggage than any candidate around. Nobody thought he'd still be in the race at this point, yet polls are indicating that he's slowly on the ascent. And if he actually does make a move, you know, he could be a surprise winner of one of these early states, and then who knows how long the race goes.
Mitt Romney, back to the governor, who performs very well in these debates because he doesn't make mistakes, and also who has the best name recognition of all these candidates. Mary, what's wrong with that for winning everything? Name recognition, adequate performance in the debates, plenty of money in the bank. Why not Mitt Romney? What can stop him?
Well, I think this issue of electability can be overplayed. Remember, Reagan was considered unelectable. He had big reform ideas. He had principles, and he stuck to those principles, and he won, and he changed America. Look, Romney may be the most experienced candidate. As I said, he's been campaigning for 4 or 5 years straight now.
Right.
But what does he run on? He can't run on health care reform. He can't run on tax reform. He can't run on job creation. What does he run on? Does he stand up and say, hi, I was a businessman. I'm competent. I look good in a suit. You should elect me president. I'm not Barack Obama. What does he run on? I just don't understand that.
That sounds like the Romney campaign button, Tegan. Doesn't that sound like Mary just gave it to us? I'm a businessman. I'm a turnaround guy. I'm not Barack Obama.
It sounds like Mary's warming to Newt Gingrich here.
Oh, geez.
No.
I didn't say that.
Is there anybody left? Let me think. We've had Palin, and she never got in, right? But then we went to Bachman, and that was up and down. And after Bachman, we moved through to Mr. Perry, and now he's disappeared into a moment that will give him a comic life far beyond death. And now the possibility is Newt Gingrich. That leaves only Rick Santorum. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to ask Mary or Tegan. I'm going to ask you, can you believe Rick Santorum to lead the Republican polls? Can you do that? Can you make that leap? I can't. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Mary Kissel's here, and we're outbound for Australia. The president's departing within hours for Hawaii for the critical ASEAN conference. And
APEC.
Then
APEC.
APEC. Thank you. Not ASEAN. ASEAN's the other people that do in Southeast Asia. APEC. And then he's headed to Australia, and he's going to visit two cities in Australia that have significance politically for Australia and for the region. So we go to Andrew Scheer, who's the director of political...
of studies.
Political studies.
Studies which, generally.
Which means I'm putting my glasses on at the Lowy Institute. Andrew, a very good morning to you. Good day, mate. All right. The president's outbound to you. We hope he gets there. The previous two trips, he's been turned back by happenstance and fate. So this time he's outbound. Why Canberra? Why Darwin? What does that mean? Good morning, Andrew.
Good evening there, John. It's great to be with you again. And I think it's a very important visit, John. As you said, the president's had two false starts in his efforts to get to Australia, and a third no-show would have looked pretty ordinary, as we say down here. But he's coming, and he's calling in Canberra, which is our capital. And when he's in Canberra, he's going to be addressing a specially convened sitting of both houses of parliament, and that's really the highest honour the Australian political system can pay to an incoming head of government. And I'm sure he'll have some messages there about America's ongoing commitment to Asia, and about the importance of free trade. He will have been at APEC beforehand for the announcement of the Trans-Pacific Partnership on Trade. So I think there'll be some important messages there about America's commitment to Asia and also to Australia through the alliance. And I guess that takes us naturally to Darwin. On the face of it, not a very plausible destination for a visiting US president. And I think that's a clue to why he's going there, and that is that he's going to announce a significant enhancement of America's military presence in Australia.
Wow. Well, Andrew, it does sound like a significant visit, but our viewers may not be aware of the military alliance between our two countries. Usually here, we're sitting in New York on the East Coast. We hear a lot about the special relationship with Britain. Mr. Obama is going to Australia. He's going to celebrate 60 years of the alliance. Can you tell us a little bit, give us a little bit of context here about what we do with Australia and what this expansion means in practice?
Sure, Mary. Well, as you say, the alliance goes back 60 years, and in fact, the defence relationship between the two countries goes way back, because Australia has fought alongside the United States in every major conflict in the last century. This is a very mature, very deep security relationship between the two countries, very close on the battlefield, as I just said, but also a vast array of intelligence cooperation between the two countries. American military forces exercise regularly in Australia, and we work together very closely, especially in Asia, but beyond that, globally, diplomatically. So it's a very, very close partnership. In the last decade, during the war on terror, it's become even closer. And this forthcoming announcement will mark another important milestone in this relationship.
And Andrew, what exactly will happen? Are we building bases there? Are we going to dock ships there? What's going on?
Mary, both countries are avoiding the B word, bases. And that's because the US military is not really looking for bases in the traditional sense, the sort of huge facilities that they have in Japan and Korea. The US is looking for a more flexible, more dispersed force posture in Asia, and Australia fits in that context. So you could expect to see, for example, a marine presence in Darwin, our northern port, with equipment pre-positioned there to help with natural disaster relief, or military operations if they became necessary. You could expect to see many more US ships and aircraft using Australia's large training ranges. And over time, I think you might expect to see American ships operating much more frequently out of our West Coast naval base just south of Perth.
Near the natural resources, John.
Yeah, the reason I want to emphasize the Australian trip for the president is that it has not been obvious these last years to the American public that Australia has been in all of the major conflicts since the attack on New York and Washington, and still remains. I saw recently, Andrew, I'm sure it was big news in Australia, three Australian soldiers were murdered by a Taliban martyr operation in Australia at the same time we had martyr operations in Kabul. Did that roil the political waters there that Australia remains committed to Afghanistan despite all of the compromises?
It did, John, and it's done some damage to Australians' faith in our Afghan security partners, to be honest. This was one of those very unfortunate situations where an Afghan soldier, or ostensibly an Afghan soldier, turned his weapon on a group of completely unprepared soldiers and killed three and wounded some others, and then to add to the shock, just last week there was another incident where a separate Afghan soldier again fired on a group of Australians and wounded three. So for a military mission in which public confidence has been eroding over the last couple of years, these recent events have caused a real sense of public shock and some doubt, I'm afraid, about the whole enterprise.
A detail here, we're speaking to Andrew Scheer of the Lowy Institute. I believe I'm right, Andrew. This is the 11th day of November in Australia, 2011, and that is Remembrance Day for Australia. Is that correct?
That's correct. And in fact, as I speak to you, John, I've got a red poppy in my suit lapel.
For all of you people who are younger than 18, here's the test. What are we remembering? The 11th day, the 11th hour, 1918, Australia's sacrifice. It's called National Remembrance Day, and it lasts from about 10 o'clock in the morning to about noontime. And because Australia's ours, he's tomorrow ahead. That's happening right now for all of Australia. We know Australia because of the sacrifice at Gallipoli, but they know the first war for the sacrifice of the whole 4 years when they were part of the Crown. So this is Armistice Day in Australia. We get to live it tomorrow, Andrew.
That's right. It's a very significant day for the whole Western Alliance, John. 60,000 young Australians didn't come back from that war, and even though it's a long time ago, one of the interesting things is that public interest in those events and public commemoration of those events is actually getting stronger, and young Australians are getting much more involved in commemorating the sacrifice of their forefathers.
Andrew Scheer of the Lowy Institute, the Director of Political Studies, National Remembrance Day ceremony in Australia for the losses of the First War. The President outbound for Australia. Mary Kissel of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Mary Kissel, the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, is here, and we're very pleased again to be joined by John Taylor, who is not only a member of the Hoover Institution, he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's the author of Getting Off Track, How Government Actions and Interventions Caused, Prolonged, and Worsened the Financial Crisis, published by Hoover Press. Mr. Taylor is a professor of economics at Stanford. John, a very good evening to you. Interventionism. that word in your book title and also in an article published, an op-ed published recently in the Wall Street Journal, that you're concerned that the United States these last years, the Barack Obama administration, has practiced what you characterize as interventionism, not only in the domestic market, but in the foreign market. Has that slowed world growth? Has that damaged the global growth picture? Good evening, Professor.
Good evening. Well, it's certainly slowed the U.S. recovery. The interventions are the stimulus packages, the cash for clunkers, first-time home buyers, all these efforts. And then, by the way, I would include some of the Federal Reserve things like the quantitative easings. All those things have really not done good in terms of stimulating the economy. They create uncertainty, held the economy back, and of course, that's not good for the world economy.
Professor, it's Mary here. When people think of interventionism in America, they do think of those fiscal issues, cash for clunkers, stimulus, etc. But you just mentioned a monetary policy the Federal Reserve sets. How does the Federal Reserve's not just ultra-low interest rates, but its willingness to do things like buy mortgage-backed securities and other kinds of assets in a seemingly random almost fashion or a very unpredictable fashion, how does that impact the global economy?
Well, it's very unpredictable. And what it does, in addition to being unpredictable, it makes U.S. policy too easy, if you like, too inflationary for the rest of the world. And so even though we're not seeing a lot of pickup in inflation now, the rest of the world is. And that's to some extent because we're exporting our inflation. And the problem with that is for the United States, it can come back and hit us. If it comes around again and could cause commodity price inflation and inflation in the U.S. So, you know, what goes around comes around. That's one of the concerns you have from these more interventionist policies. We had policies through most of the 80s and 90s until relatively recently, which was much more predictable and focused on price stability. We had these long expansions, and it worked pretty well.
So, Professor, just to translate for the non-economist audience out there, so most of the world's trade is denominated in dollars. So if the Federal Reserve sets the interest rates too low and prints too many dollars, it devalues the value of that money and upsets the global economy. Do I have that right? Do I remember
exactly
my econ 10?
Right. Okay. Good way to put it.
Great.
Absolutely.
We're speaking with John Taylor. Right now, there's a crisis in Europe, Professor. It starts in Athens. It moves to Rome. Now there are concerns of France. Eastern Europe is a collateral damage to this. Is that in any fashion connected to the policy from the Federal Reserve and this long holding of interest rates down through the crisis?
I think this came from an earlier episode where the United States held interest rates very low in 2003, 4, and 5, and it caused some of the housing boom we had in the United States and some of the excess risk-taking, and ultimately, I think, led to the crisis that we had. And during that period, those low rates led other countries to have rates which were too low, and led to housing booms in such places as, yes, Greece and Ireland and Spain. And so, yes, part of that is related to the policy in the U.S. And I'd say now it's more that we're doing sort of the same kinds of things, and the effects, we don't know. Hope it doesn't come back and hurt us in the same way, but it could certainly do that.
Professor, in terms of the example that the United States sets, it's not just the monetary policy of the Federal Reserve or the fiscal policies of the stimulus. It's also our openness to trade.
Absolutely.
What example have we set for the rest of the world, and why should the listener out there, wherever he or she may be, care?
Well, in the past, we've set examples. In the 80s, when we moved to a policy that focused on like getting tax rates down and open markets and less regulation. That was, of course, the same time where you saw emerging market countries, including China, taking on the more free market approach, and it spread. And that's really why a lot of emerging market countries are doing much better now. They took our example. And even earlier, if you go back after World War II, the United States was really a leader in reducing barriers to trade through multilateral efforts and setting up international organizations. And we're just doing much less of that now, and to some extent because we ourselves are having more regulations, and we're also limiting the ability for entrepreneurs and questioning the predictability and the rule of law. So that's not a good example to set for the rest of the world.
The G20 just finished in Cannes, France, and they were all focused on the crisis of Greece. But the question here is, how is the United States regarded at that meeting? And there's the suggestion in your piece in the Journal, John, that the United States was treated as just another interventionist, troublemaking, get-along-to-go-along economy and not a leader at all. Is that accurate, or am I overstating the case?
Well, maybe a little overstating, to be honest, but I think the problem is, for the last 2 years, the United States has been urging more of these, you know, stimulus packages, and the rest of the world should do it too, but except for early 2009, we've been rejected. The U.S. has been rejected in those proposals. And people have said, no, we don't need that. We worry about our debt, and we have these other problems. So it puts us in a more difficult position to lead, plus the fact that our economy itself is not growing very rapidly, you know, compared to emerging markets. And that also makes us less, like, if you like, less leadership in terms of the qualities required.
I want to take you to a refutation of your thesis in the Wall Street Journal by your colleague David Glasner, who writes that you were wrong in promoting the U.S. as a leader after World War II. You think Mr. Glasner has misunderstood you. Is that correct, Professor?
Oh, yeah. No, I think the United States in that period, we set up and were really largely responsible for setting up this general agreement on tariffs and trade. And what that did was remove lots of barriers. Tariffs came down dramatically in that period. We also tried to promote capital markets that were freer, that removed some of the capital controls that were put on in World War II. So I think just generally, and we, you know, at a period where much of the world was under central planning and communism, we strove to be really a leadership position on all issues related to freedom. We showed examples of in our culture, or whether it's medicine, pharmaceuticals, the entertainment industry, all these things which demonstrated the great values of freedom, economic freedom, and personal and political freedom, and ultimately the world has changed dramatically because of that. So I think it really was U.S. leadership, largely by example, that did that.
Professor, I sense a danger, and that is coming from commentators, economists, academics, and others who look at the state of the economy right now in the U.S. and in Western Europe and say, well, maybe these command and control economies over there in Asia have a better idea of how to do it. Maybe they've come up with the magic formula to grow. Do you sense that danger as well? Is that something that you've observed, and can you comment on it?
I do see that interpretation. I think it's the wrong interpretation, because the reason why China has been doing so much better since they put in those reforms in the late 70s and 80s is because they've moved towards a more capitalist system, towards more focus on markets. They do still have a tremendous amount of intervention in their economies, and that causes us problems at this point in time. So there is a danger of misinterpreting what's happened, and that's another reason I think why it's so important for the United States to really get back to the kinds of policies, the economic freedom policies that were quite useful and worked for us in the past, rather than to look like we're not doing so well.
Mary, it's a treat to have our own world-scale economist to call on every time Mr. Bernanke makes a remark.
So He's a legend.
We spoke the last time before the November meeting. Here we are after the November meeting. So, okay, John, you're aware that the Federal Reserve has lowered its expectations for 2012 and has modest expectations for 2011. It is modest for next year. At the same time, they have the dual track of inflation, which Mr. Bernanke says there's very little evidence of, and jobs. So he is going to continue to hold the course, and they've even flirted with the idea of a QE3. Is the Federal Reserve part of the problem for next year, why we're growing so poorly? Can we translate right into the weak job market, John?
I think it's a factor. It's part of this very activist government policy that makes things less predictable. People now have to even predict what the Fed will do. Will they have a QE3? Will they try to twist the term structure of interest rates around? Will they intervene in the mortgage market again? So all that creates unpredictability and uncertainty, and that's the last thing the market needs right now. So I think a more focused Fed on its ultimate goals, which is to maintain the purchasing power of the currency, and to get out of all this, these special activities would be better for the economy. And in that sense, the Fed is a factor here.
And Mr. Bernanke, is he sensitive to that criticism? Does he listen, John?
Well, he certainly hears it. I think if you look what he's gotten, he went through in the crisis, it brought out a lot of interventionist policies, of course, the bailouts, which everyone questions at this point, but some other very unusual things they did. So I think the Fed got into a very activist, interventionist mode. To me, it's like what they did in the 70s, where the results were not so good either. And once you're in that mode, it's kind of hard to get out. And I think that's the situation now.
John Taylor, professor of economics, Stanford, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, Mary Kissel, the editorial board of The Wall Street Journal. I'm John Batchelor. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Poor news about Phobos Grunt, the outbound probe to Mars. We wait for good news on Curiosity. Right now, we're looking at the red planet itself. There is a conjunction you can catch if you get up very early in the morning in these next hours, East Coast, West Coast. Mars will be very close to the big blue star Regulus. They'll be so close, just look in the morning. Right before the dawn, Mars and Regulus will be very close together. Here's Al.
Midnight were the stars and you. Midnight and a rendezvous. Your eyes held a message tender, saying I surrender all my love to you. Midnight brought us sweet romance. I know all my whole life through I'll be remembering you whatever else I do. Midnight were the stars and you.
Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs represents all of the success that came to the end of its story in the financial crisis of 2008. And yet, you say, Goldman Sachs, it survived. We put money from the Federal from the Treasury and money made available from the Federal Reserve, and Goldman Sachs, among other banks that were investment banks, became bank holding companies and became banks too big to fail. And here we are today. You can't actually put your money in Goldman Sachs. It's not a retail bank, but it's doing well. Or is it? Susan Craig, who writes Dealbook for the New York Times, right now commenting on 21 days in the third quarter that led to trading losses that have disappointed Goldman investors and puzzled me profoundly as to what's going on with the banks of the world. Sue, a very good evening to you. The blame shifting here is that it had a bad couple of days in which it lost $100 million on one particular nine-day run. That's a bad time at a casino, but when you're talking about an investment bank with a world-class reputation, I'm always looking for the secret of these bad 21 days or bad 9 days. Is there one explanation from Goldman?
I mean, times are changing over there. I mean, if they were a casino, they'd be down tens of millions of dollars. They lost 300 and some million in the quarter. It's a sign that it's just tougher to make money.
It's tougher to make money, but you know, they're bettors. They're into risk. They have risk management. They have an appetite for it. Their stock, however, reflects a lack of confidence in the investor class, which includes some of the biggest bundlers in the world. So is this a way of looking? I'm always looking for a window. Can I look through this one window and see the shakiness of the world global banking situation?
I mean, I think you can. I think you're seeing you're seeing the environment shift. I mean, this has gone from you know, to use your analogies of gambling and casino, a company that was, you know, making bets on huge amounts of leverage and doing very well at it, to one that, you know, has reduced its leverage and is just having a lot more trouble eking out profit. In some cases, it's losing money, and it's not alone. All these banks are struggling to sort of figure out this new environment where we've got troubles in Europe. We read about it every day, and you've got new regulations that are going to, you know, crimp profit elsewhere. I mean, it's just a really difficult environment, and you're seeing Goldman, you know, who's known for being the best trading house on the street, really struggling with it.
And, of course, they hold a contest every day at Goldman, and if you win, you get to keep your job. So this is not a group of people who put up with failure. What I'm reading on this is that the failure might be widespread, but let's focus. Is this Dodd-Frank? Is this prop trading? Is this doubts about the banking system? Is Goldman still playing blame-shifting games during the quarterly reports?
No, I mean, I don't know if it's much as blame-shifting, but it's a lot of the things that you said. You have got troubles in Europe, so their clients are pulling back. That's a big part of it. You've got Dodd-Frank, which is really, you know, these regulations are taking a huge toll on them. They're having to put up more capital in the businesses that they're in, which means they simply, you know, can make less profit in those. And then in other cases, like proprietary trading, where they would actually make directional bets with their own capital, they're out of that altogether. I mean, so it's a lot of things that have come together, and it's just changed the makeup of these firms. Goldman Sachs, for example, used to post a return on equity, you know, into the 30s, you know, 25-35%. You know, it's now, you know, generally when we deal with it, under 10%, and the quarter that we're talking about right now, where it had the rough trading days, is only the second in its history as a publicly traded company where it lost money.
And I pay attention when somebody who's used to running a transcontinental railroad says to me, well, we just had trouble once, you know, we're not going to have it again. Mm-hmm. We've settled that. We've hired the guy with the straw hat, and we're going to bring Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid to justice. Okay, I'm thinking, fine.
Well, and if you're listening to it, this isn't the first time. I mean, the last quarter, I mean, let's just go through it. The last quarter, the second quarter, they sort of admitted that they miscalculated. They actually pulled in their risk because they felt that the markets would be more turbulent than they were. The markets weren't, so they had a bunch of hedges on that cost them money, and they made less money than analysts thought in the second quarter. They really haven't had a kind of knock it out of the quarter since, I'm going back just in my head here, but early 2010. And then before that, you've got the financial crisis, and they actually lost money in the last quarter of 2008.
The European debt crisis, you've mentioned it a couple of times.
Yeah.
And we've had difficulty, and I've talked to colleagues of yours and over at the Journal where you work, mm-hmm. happily, and there's a lot of guessing going on as to what the exposure is. $150 billion seems a good number, so does $700 billion. And I note from the list that you publish here, Sue, in the New York Times, the company said it had $23.8 billion exposure to France, $24.4 billion to Germany, $7.6 billion to Ireland. That doesn't, of course, add in the problems in Italy and Athens and others in Eastern Europe. That adds up pretty soon to real money.
And what you're looking at is sort of the numbers, some of the numbers that we had in the story where we talk about the quarter was their, you know, their total exposure. Should they not be able to get out of France tomorrow, period? It's a huge exposure. But when you're talking about credit risk, which is sort of, you know, some of the exposure to the sovereign debt and that sort of thing, it comes down for Goldman, for example, just to Italy, they have, when it's hedged, $700 million. If it's not, it goes up by a few billion. But the question that people, when they see, well, we have, you know, unhedged, the gross exposure on sovereign debt risk is $2 to $3 billion. I mean, a lot of times you wonder if these hedges are going to work. It's not a perfect system. But let's say it is, and you still go down to $700 or $800 million. That represents a sizable, you know, it's not a majority, but a 15-20% of the profit that Goldman has eked out so far this year. So should they lose that, or something happened, or if it's marked down to 50%, if the debt's marked down to 50%, it would come out to 10% of their profit. We're not talking small numbers. I mean, these are sort of worst-case scenarios, but if you add it up country by country, it gets to be, you know, big numbers.
Sue Craig, reporting for Dealbook on Goldman Sachs. No blaming here. We're just looking for signs. Stay with the Transcontinental Railroad. Okay, there's smoke in the far distance. Is that an Indian raid? Is something going wrong that we need to know about back here in San Francisco? I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good night.